Hi, this is Paul. This weekend, Slavoj Žižek had his conversation with Jordan Peterson on Good Friday, and I've entitled the conversation The Hopeful Humanist versus the Merry Pessimist. And what was so interesting to me was that a communist and a pragmatist meet to debate capitalism, Marxism, and happiness, and the most interesting thing they find to talk about is Christian theology. That's where the whole conversation went. I thought that was amazing. And one person, Adam and Sitch, tried to do a two-hour conversation instead. Of course, they did a four-hour one. And one of the super chats in there that I guess it's worth your money, whoever made that super chat, is Žižek is a Marxist as Peterson is a Christian. And when I read that, it was like, bang, there's something to think about. Let's jump in. Why did Jordan Peterson do this? Did he do this to discredit postmodern neo-Marxism? Did he do it to expand his reach and influence into Žižek's fan base? Was he setting out to discredit Žižek as an intellectual or as a Marxist? Or did he do it to promote his message? Peterson is all about promoting his message. And Peterson is in many ways on a world-saving tour to save Western civilization, to save individuals from nihilistic caused depression. And that's, in a sense, that's Jordan Peterson's evangelistic crusade. Well, what is his message? Actually, one of the really cool things about this conversation was Žižek pushed him into giving some really terrific, concise summaries of Jordan Peterson's what I'll call gospel. Towards the end of the evening, in the most spontaneous elements, he articulated it very succinctly and briefly, and we'll get there. Now, Jordan Peterson had the first 25-minute statement. They each began with a 25-minute statement, and I sort of agree with Sitch and Adam that, you know, they probably would have been better off, those two, having some private conversation or at least swap some papers they would write to get to know each other, because the first hour didn't really produce a whole lot, and I'll go into that. Well, how did Jordan Peterson use his first 25-minute statement? If you watched the April question and answer, you know exactly how he used it, because he told us all what he was going to do, and in fact, he did it. He attacked the Marxist Communist Manifesto on 10 points, and I thought they were great points. Was it a good opening move for Peterson? Well, again, that depends on what his goal was. Was it to discredit neo-Marxism? Was it to discredit Žižek as a Marxist? Was it to expand his influence into Žižek's base or to promote his own message? It seemed like the reason he would start with an approach like that, working on those 10 points, would be an attempt to discredit postmodern neo-Marxism, or at least what he calls that, this thing that he keeps attacking, by attacking the Communist Manifesto. Now, it was Good Friday, and I had bigger names to serve than Jordan Peterson and Slavoj Žižek, and so I didn't get to hear the whole thing that evening. But one of the, I noticed that Adam was doing a little bit of tweeting during the event, and one of the things that I noted right at the beginning of the event was, listening to Peterson's strategy, the easiest thing that Žižek could do was basically say, that's not what kind of Marxist I am, or the Communist Manifesto isn't really Marxism today, or any number of these moves, and boom, Peterson's first 25 minutes were mostly futile, which is sort of what happened. Peterson basically said the Communist Manifesto is incoherent and wrong-headed, which was proven by the communist experiments of the 20th century. Peterson's right. Capitalism has its faults, but it's done pretty well in raising the material comfort and well-being on the planet. That's true, too. The challenges we face are not unique to capitalism, but as he often points out, like when he talks about a whole number of things, inequality is built into nature. It's not simply a function of capitalism or democracy or any of these things. The issues are far older and far more difficult than just trying to get rid of one particular economic system like capitalism. And these are points that Peterson has made in a good many times in a good many places all throughout his lectures on maps of meaning, so on and so forth. So none of that was any big surprise. This is pretty standard Peterson stuff. In my evaluation of his opener, he was quite disciplined, especially for a famous stream of consciousness rambler. Peterson kept to his points, and he worked through them, and he was coherent, and, you know, it was a good presentation. I think he showed his balance, which is he's often a lot more balanced than the sort of left-wing hit job caricature that he's usually subject to. And I thought this was good probably for Žižek's audience and for Žižek to notice that Peterson is not some crazy conservative, crazy neo-fascist or custodian of the patriarchy or all these silly things that get slammed on him. He's a very balanced guy, and he makes really good points about the fact that reality is very difficult and the challenges that every economic system faces are far deeper than just the systems that have come up and their failures of them over the last couple of hundred years. And so I thought it was a good presentation, his first 25 minutes. I didn't know whether or not it would really serve him or the purpose of the evening. The main question was who really is being addressed by addressing the Communist Manifesto. Last week, the Distributist did a Magic Words and his Magic Words series. He did one on capitalism, brought forward many of the similar points as Peterson did, and I thought the Distributist's video on this was excellent. And so the points were good, but I wasn't sure whether the points would really serve the conversation of the evening that much. My experience would be socialists, at least in the United States, even blue state, even in California, America, and complainers about capitalism, I see near zero appetite for 20th century ownership of the means of production in North America. I worked in the Dominican Republic for a good number of years, and the dictator Trujillo famously took over all the private industry sugarcane operations, at least most of them, not the ones in the far east of the country in the La Romana area. But nationalization of these corporations usually yields the predictable result, which is corruption and poor management and pretty much a disaster. These are pretty standard conservative talking points. And even in places like Scandinavia, you don't see widespread state ownership of all kinds of industries. Those days are done, and we don't see anybody really going back to them. Now, it's fashionable to complain about capitalism if you want to present yourself as having concern for the poor, and that's pretty standard stuff. And from what I talk, when I talk to people in the United States and Canada often, people seem to want European-level social services at an American tax rate. And, you know, everybody's in favor of raising taxes on somebody else. And it's usually some professors and students without jobs. Now, the identity politics, which both of them attacked pretty, both Peterson and Žižek attacked pretty severely, is really, I think, the heart of a lot of Peterson's focus and the importance of a lot of the conversation. And that's been going on much more broadly, too, with Peter Boghossian and James Lindsay and Helen Pluckrose and Brett Weinstein and the IDW. That's really the center of the war. Is it so much Marxism? I really agree with Neil Shenvey, who's become an apologist, a Christian who's been making a lot of noise about critical theory, that probably in terms of nomenclature, we probably shouldn't be talking about postmodern neo-Marxism as much as critical theory, and that seems to be a much better targeting of what's going on in terms of what people in America and Canada and the UK and Australia and other places are really promoting, not so much postmodern neo-Marxism or whatever it is out there. And so to that degree, this great debate was no debate at all. The political battle in the United States, I don't really talk about politics much, but I'll just give it a slide. The political battle in the United States is usually market forces versus state regulation and control. What should the government own? How deeply should the government be involved in healthcare? This is obviously a big debate, ongoing debate in the United States through many administrations. George W. Bush, the Barack Obama administration, Donald Trump. Donald Trump was going to take on healthcare until his party said, "Don't you dare," and so then he shut up about it until maybe after the re-election he'll give us the best healthcare imaginable for almost no money, just like he promised during the 2016 campaign. In many ways, the major issues in the United States, apart from the social legislation, the identity politics, moralism front, is the question of the percentage of government reach. And actually, Reagan framed this in a way. And while it looked early like it might, things might change under the Trump administration, he'd been much more of a traditional Republican in many ways than all the populist campaign talk. Boom, there's your political slide. Back to the debate. Was this a good move for Peterson? Does the Communist Manifesto still have a large and devoted audience behind that document? I don't know. I don't hear a lot of it. Does Zizek rely on the Communist Manifesto? This was my introduction to his work. And he came out a number of times and basically, well, we'll talk about how he identifies himself. Zizek could simply ignore Peterson's opener and regain the initiative by stating that, well, he doesn't agree with the Communist Manifesto or 20th century communism, which he did. And Jordan Peterson hasn't really read enough Marx, or later on, Zizek will say Hegel. My big surprise in Peterson's opening was, frankly, why he went there at all. Because with happiness, capitalism, and Marxism, Jordan Peterson's sacrament is meaning. And this came through later in the conversation. I don't know why he didn't lead with his main point and with his main work. For pity's sakes, the name of this book is Maps of Meaning. And I think he could have, if he had stuck to his own material right off the bat, probably could have gotten the conversation in quicker, because put up in front what your main contribution is. Meaning is his sacrament and the main message of his work. Meaning trumps happiness, as Zizek will note later on. In fact, in many ways, it sounded like Zizek was playing Peterson's tune in a number of places in the evening. He could have used meaning as a way of attacking Marxism and nuancing capitalism, which he does very well on many occasions. So I really didn't understand why Peterson... Well, I don't like it when people say I really don't. Well, I don't understand why he made the moves he did. And if hindsight is 20/20 and looking back on it and having what he obviously didn't that evening, it's far harder being on stage and having to think of something in the minute than sitting back, watching something four or five times and being a Monday morning pundit. But I think he would have been better off beginning with really what is his main contribution to the conversation right now. Why go off into the Communist Manifesto when the big points are right here? This is your work. A lot of the discrediting communism and Marx has all been done before by other people and done well. Zizek offered a friendly, insightful buffet on the road to certain perdition. That was my best summary of Zizek's initial contribution. He is the merry pessimist. He is the merry nihilist. He is a fun guy to listen to. And what he, in a sense, does is strings together a string of really interesting baubles or pearls that are fascinating to listen to, many of which I would agree with. Many of which have wonderful insights in terms of observations and punditry and wisdom, but what is the string that holds them together? That's really the question that I have with respect to Zizek. While Peterson was focused and well-organized, which was a fun thing to see from Jordan Peterson, even though I think his strategy was misguided, Zizek gives you a string of pearls, lots of clever insights strung together, but the string itself is terribly difficult to discern. He is in practice more consistently postmodern in that he deconstructs everything and everyone, including himself. He, I think, in some ways was the most postmodern presentation I have ever heard, honestly. Postmodern. In this talk, there is little or no hope or promise beyond the momentary enjoyment of pointing out reasons for despair. This is the fun, at least this evening. This is my only serious introduction into him. The guy is brilliant. He's creative. He's a very astute critic. He seems very honest and courageous, but finally, the string that contains all of these different pearls is despair. There is no hope. But along the way, we've got lots of interesting and funny and curious observations to make, poking holes and deconstructing just about everything around us. But in the end, it's all going to be for loss. probably, because if you'd say it will surely be for loss, that's almost too positive. So he's the most postmodern guy I think I've ever seen. He identifies as a Hegelian, offers a great Hegel quote that I had never heard of, which seems completely appropriate to Zizek. Evil resides in the gaze, which sees evil everywhere. He sees evil and problems absolutely everywhere. He applied it to the American political left with their Donald Trump obsession. He also takes swipes at Donald Trump and nearly everything else. It could be applied to nearly every point in the string of pearls. And there's no such authority in nature, which is another thing that he said that evening, nor any metaphysical or any meta-narrative. There's no authority at all. You know, this is chaos and sound and fury, and the best we can do is take a moment and enjoy the absurdity of the show. And that seems, at least based on this evening, seems to be Zizek. Delightful, fun to talk to, a great guy to hang around with, it seems, fun to listen to, but that's the message. I've listened to this 4 or 5 times now. Parenthetically, all on the boot, all on the pirated version, because the version I paid for, I coughed up the $15. I still haven't been able to watch it legally because I couldn't watch it that evening because I had Good Friday services. So there's no authority in nature. There's no authority in meta-narrative. There's no authority, period. It's all chaos. And so to the degree that we can enjoy the moment of laughing and noting and having a degree of relish in terms of identifying the obscurity of existence, woohoo! There you have it, baby. Are we reduced to clever and entertaining nihilism? That kind of seems to be it for him. Now, his point at the end, so you have this big ramble, this string of pearls here, and you wonder where the string is going or what the string is, and you get to the end and he says this, you know, why does he, Zizek, continue to cling to identifying as a Marxist communist, which is actually a question that Peterson asks him a little bit later in the evening. And I kind of wonder if it isn't simply because of the absurdity of it all, because he himself understands how catastrophic and murderous Marxist communism was, but he's going to identify as one simply to be himself, embody the theater of the absurd. Does today's capitalism maintain strong, this is his big question, does today's capitalism maintain strong enough antagonisms to prevent its indefinite reproduction, meaning capitalism will simply go on and on and on and on and on until it destroys the world. Well, it does contain antagonisms within it, at least three that he identified, which is environmental catastrophe, the neural link, which would destroy humanity and destroy ourselves, and human nature. In other words, it's all going to end, folks. We're going to kill ourselves. And so we'll kill ourselves before the universe does. There's the absurdity. Market is not utopia. The states are large in the West. In fact, one of the things that the West has done is kind of been able to balance state control to give us some of the securities we want by leveraging the state with kind of markets. And he talks quite a bit about China. And early on when he started talking about China, you'd think that, well, China seems to be the goal of what he's talking about. Maybe China is it. But later on, he comes back around and undermines it and says, you know, it's terrifying to me that to think that China might be our future for all of us. Yeah, terrifying for me too. Not terrifying for a good number of Chinese, however. And he ends his thing with a very familiar commentary. When you see light in the tunnel, it's probably just another train. And then everybody applauds. And I just think, are we all really that cynical? Is really the best we can do the absurdity of chaos, and we laugh and joke our way until the demise, which is affected by our own hand? You know, every now and then he will say something like, well, we need more cooperative effort, but that always leads to tyranny, and so that won't work either. We're doomed, but let's have fun along the way. So then everybody's applauding at the end of his 30-minute presentation. There are a lot of Zizek fans in the crowd, obviously, and he says, don't applaud. The theater of the absurd simply continues with him. Don't take it as a cheap competition, although that may be, I'm sure, because of CAA, everyone was paid handsomely from a sold-out theater and $15 a head for a streaming thing that barely worked. We're desperately trying to comfort, to confront serious problems, but he offers very little hope that there will be any confrontation of these serious problems. But given his pessimism, and this is my point, why? Is there an optimism beneath his pessimistic nihilism he can't account for but yet acts out? I think could be. Because, you know, as Peterson mentions often, we're acting out our axioms. And either it's Zizek is simply the theater of the absurd, or maybe he's religious down deep, and there's a degree of optimism within him which even his theater of absurd pessimistic nihilism has not been able to fully eradicate. And it's done well for him in the marketplace, for Pete's sake. How more absurd can you get for a Marxist communist? Now, Jordan Peterson gets 10 more minutes. And he says, it isn't obvious to me that we can solve the problems that confront us. Okay. It's possible that human ingenuity might solve the environmental problems. And this, again, if you've listened to as much Jordan Peterson as many of us have, this is a point he makes regularly. He's a hopeful humanist. He won't defend capitalists as a world saver, but evidence that it has brought, but there's plenty of evidence that has brought some good into this world. And what he says to Zizek, I think, is exactly right. I didn't hear an alternative from you. Yep, you didn't, because it's all pessimism. The world is going to hell in a handbasket. Let's have a funny and absurd time along the way. I think if Peterson really wanted to get into this, and if he does a second conversation, he should, in fact, address Zizek's nihilism and his pessimism directly, because that really is the difference. And if you can have fun while you're being, while we're being simply the victims of social humanity self-destruction, well, if that's the best you got, in a sense, maybe you should just come out and say it, and say, that is the string upon which I build all of my pearls. Now Jordan Peterson finally gets to his gospel. Again, I wish he had addressed this right at the front. This is his 10 minutes rebuttal. Individual moral responsibility aimed at the highest good. That's Peterson's message. It's rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition. Each person is sovereign and a locus of ultimate value that you can accept regardless of your religious presuppositions. And I think, yeah, except that itself is a religious presupposition, because there are many religious and many religions with presuppositions that do not have that, including Zizek. Although Zizek will, again, with his theater of the comedic absurd, say, well, there's some good in there too. And so in a sense, in some way, Zizek is the book of Ecclesiastes without the last chapter. And if you don't know what I'm saying, find a Bible. Don't worry. It's the most published book in all of human history. It's online all over the place in public domain. Look up the book of Ecclesiastes. Read it. Enjoy it, because it's probably the book in the Bible that just about any atheist, philosophically inclined atheist, would enjoy. And just skip the last chapter. I think Zizek would be very at home in the book in many ways. And then, of course, Peterson lays into his Piaget equilibrated state, which, again, is one of the real jewels that I've been able to pick up from Peterson, and it's from Piaget, and it's really what it is and how it serves for Peterson is his psychological vision of the kingdom of God or the city on the hill. That is, in fact, when Rebel Wisdom asked Peterson, made a comment to Peterson about my characterizing his gospel as Stoicism, he said, well, what's on the top of the kingdom on the hill? Well, Vander Clay hasn't been listening, the city of God. Okay, continue to define it for me. And that definition, I think, is, for Peterson, Piaget's equilibrated state, because that becomes Peterson's eschatology. And so now in this section, Peterson lays out his gospel, which I really wish he had started with in the evening, because I think this is actually Peterson's shtick. This is his contribution. This is what is helping people. Now I think it's deficient in some theological ways, but this is a good thing that he's promoting, and it's helping people, and good things are coming of it. So then Žižek gets another 10 minutes, and he notes he's going to continue to deconstruct everything, including happiness, and he problematizes happiness even more, and notes that some people in Bangladesh, despite their deprivations, are happier than people in Scandinavia, which is something that I'd never heard anybody point out. And he's saying this isn't any simplistic, oh, the poor are happy in their misery. It's a point that happiness is a far more difficult thing to figure out. And then he says, and this is a quote because I recorded it as a quote, happiness comes as a byproduct of you working towards a cause. And I thought, good. Peter Žižek just took Peterson's book. If you want to put the book in one line, there it is, baby. And Žižek just laid it right out. And of course, Peterson is agreeing because that's Peterson's point. So Peterson, meaning is Peterson's sacrament. It connects heaven and earth for Jordan Peterson, if in fact you want to frame him in an axial type mythology. And Žižek is charming Peterson by promoting his sacrament. And so one of the takeaways of the evening is Žižek charmed Peterson. He really did. And as Sitch and Adam had mentioned, it kind of becomes best buds. You know, they end the evening with, boy, we can be friends. We can be pals. We're singing from the same book, but they're not really. Again, and I'll make this point a number of times during this. China may show that we need evil to remind us of the good we lose. And he talked about eating meat in Slovakia and lots of points like that. And he said, you know, Marx in other writings, and again, this is how you completely sidestep Peterson's initial introduction. You haven't read enough Marx, Jordan, because here in these other obscure places in Marx, since I've read way more Marx than you, and I've actually lived under an actual communist situation, Marx in other writings dismisses egalitarianism. And Peterson's not ready to concede that point, as he makes mention later, and Žižek agrees with Peterson on many points. The problem with oceans is you can't leave it to the market. You need cooperative action. But, as Žižek continues to remind us, there's very little hope for cooperative action from human beings. And Žižek has a point. And then in a sense, he says, don't shine on my pessimism. Look at South Africa. And all this identitarian critical theory politics goes out the window when basically you had a tyrannical white government now being replaced by a tyrannical black government. Tyranny is not a function of skin color. Tyranny is what people do. And people come in lots of colors, but they all do tyranny. And there we have it. Every time you try to pursue a good, you bring in unintended consequences, he says to Peterson. Peterson, you're too hopeful. You're too idealistic. You think this world can be saved? Give it up. I just see problems, as Žižek says. And then Žižek's smiling takedown, which was pretty brutal. Usually Marxists have this stupid optimist anthropology. He's calling Peterson's Augustinian anthropology overly optimistic. Just get rid of the capitalists and we'll all be happy. My God, I'm more of a pessimist. Yeah, you sure are. I don't believe in human goodness. No, you sure don't. I never underestimate evil, envy. It's part of my nature. And then he gives us a Slovenian proverb. A godlike figure comes to a farmer and says, What I do for you, I will do twice to your neighbor. And the farmer says, take out one of my eyes. Whoo! And this is, you know, here's the thing about Žižek. So if you want to put this in terms of winning and losing, you know, by what means would Peterson win the evening? Probably by expanding his reach, having Žižek's audience be open to him. What would be Žižek's form of winning? Have Peterson's audience, and that would be me, be open to Žižek, And what Žižek does is he smiles in your face and he just sticks a knife in Peterson's optimism right in that moment. And Peterson's happy. And it's like, yeah, we're in the theater of the absurd and we're enjoying it. But you know what? It's all coming to an end. That's nihilism, baby. Having fun or being depressed. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And you know what? We're going to die at our own hand. To me, one listening to Žižek in this evening, that's who he is. But he's doing it by hosting a lovely party. There's a lovely string of pearls. Just don't look at what's holding the pearls together. And here, he slips in the knife and says, Peterson, you're just too optimistic. It's all lost. Let me tell you about a farmer. The godlike figure comes and says, I'll do twice to your neighbor what I'll give to you. And the farmer says, take out one of my eyes. I want to see my neighbor blind. That's humanity. Now, Augustinian humanity, total depravity, as we Calvinists call it, does not mean everybody as bad as they could be. It just means that everyone is tainted by sin. We all miss the mark. That's what, in my opinion, Calvinist total depravity means. Žižek's total depravity, I think it's the other kind. Jordan Peterson asks, why are you known as a Marxist? Well, that's a good question. Marx gets a lot wrong, but in other places, besides the communist Mesto, Žižek says he gets a lot right. Žižek identifies more as a Hegelian than a Marxist. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know anything about Žižek. Now I know that. I'm not going to forget this point. He doesn't like Marxist teleology. Of course he doesn't like Marxist teleology, because Marxist teleology is hopeful. We're going to arrive at utopia. And Žižek, he has no hope in his world. We're not going to arrive at utopia. We're all lost. We just don't know it yet. So at least have fun while we're watching each other kill each other. This is his message. But the thing is, if you just listen to him kind of on a surface area, you don't get it. Listen to it about three or four times and really pay attention to what Žižek says. And I think you will agree with me. This is his message. And I don't think he's even a Hegelian for that. Because in Hegel, you know, whenever you act, you err. But now Hegel also, Marx lends his utopianism, gets it from Hegel's sort of pseudo-Christian utopianism. And go back and watch Paul Maxwell's video that I promoted in my promoted. I did promote it. It was a good video that I mentioned. I'll try and remember to put the link in this one that I mentioned in my videos last week. And listen to his section on Hegel, because there's thesis, antithesis, synthesis, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And as let's jump over to the notes of Philip Carey's Religion and Philosophy in the West. Hegel contends that the whole of world history unfolds according to a divine and necessary logic. This is not Žižek. History unfolds dialectically, according to a logic in which every conflict is subsumed in a higher unity. This unfolding is a process by which Geist, the universal mind or divine spirit, alienated itself in the external world. And Žižek will kind of touch on this in his reading of Genesis 3 in the fall. But eventually comes back to itself in self-knowledge. The Christian religion represents the self-alienation and self-knowledge of the divine in a powerful but mythological way. And Hegel thinks his own philosophy is the subsumption of this mythological representation into a philosophical concept through which the divine spirit becomes fully conscious of itself for the first time. So, yeah, Hegel thought a lot of himself. But I don't know how Žižek is a Hegelian either. He seems to be the kind of Hegelian that says, well, you know, it isn't just all going to keep building up until we arrive at utopia. And again, Paul Maxwell, I think, articulates this well. It's all just lost. It's all just lost. But let's have fun on the way. Then Zizek's question. Jordan Peterson decries postmodern neo-Marxism. Who are these Marxists? Who are these people? And Jordan Peterson is attacking a hypomoralization which really isn't Marxist, Zizek will say. It's just cheap identity politics, impotent moralization. I think Zizek has a point. I think, again, cleaning up our act and talking more about critical theory probably hits the mark better than postmodern neo-Marxism. Neil is right. Jordan Peterson's sleight of hand towards identity oppression and replacing class struggles. I think that's a powerful narrative that Peterson gives, and I think there's some truth in it. But I think, again, here, labels are just kind of slippery. And while you'll have a lot of critical theory people identifying with Marxism, it gets into the question of whether John Calvin was a Calvinist. I've talked about this in previous videos, because you've got the 16th century Calvin himself, and then you've got the 17th century scholastic Calvinism that kind of takes it in a different way. And so many would argue that even Calvin isn't a Calvinist, according to how many people define Calvinists. And in the same way, and perhaps Marx isn't a Marxist, how a whole bunch of people that are espousing critical theory claim Marxism to be. And so we just have this slippery world of labels. So choose the label that choose. Generally speaking, it's good to use the label that your verbal opponents are choosing for themselves, rather than giving them a label that they're going to resist, because then you just spend a lot of time slipping around on the labeling conversation and not enough time actually being able to compare what people are really asserting in terms of the conversation. So they agreed on the enemies, but disagreed on the labels. Decry those, enjoying your own self-marginalization. Which again, Zizek is so clever, and he's so fun to listen to. But if you really listen to him and think him through, those enjoying their own self-marginalization are just another act in the theater of the absurd on the way to our communal perdition. That's what's left. Then the moderator weighs in, and I thought the guy did a great time. And the test of a good moderator is that he facilitates the people to have a productive conversation. And in this case, it wasn't too hard, because once they got past the opening statements, both guys had a great conversation, and they did very, very well. And so the moderator didn't get in the way or impose himself. But here, I think in many ways, the question that he asked opened up one of the most, really, from this point on, the conversation flowed beautifully and was productive, and it was just a delight to listen to. What is true and deep human happiness? Big question. Jordan Peterson got to go first. Happiness is a side effect. It's something that comes upon you like an act of grace. And a lot of Christians got very excited when they heard that. Well, what do these guys mean by grace? Because grace is a word, whereas a lot of words in Christianity have fallen on hard times, grace is a word that has not. Just ask you to. A beautiful song about grace. Zizek then then brings in this quote: "The category of grace can be used in a perfect atheist sense." Well, that's interesting. It's one of the deepest categories. Well, that's interesting. Perfect atheist sense. Well, what is grace? Well, if you went to catechism in a Christian church, you might have heard God's riches at Christ's expense. And that's kind of a Sunday school catechism definition of grace. Obviously, an atheist wouldn't use that. But grace is sort of undeserved mercy, undeserved gift, something that from Peterson and Zizek sort of falls from above. Well, that's very interesting, especially when there's nobody up there to drop it. It's a happy accident of chaos. Now, Peterson is an open agnostic. Peterson is not willing to completely write off, even if Sam Harris pushes him into a corner in Vancouver, not completely write off the resurrection, not completely write off God number two, not completely write off grace. And so here they have an interesting conversation about grace. Jordan Peterson, we're subject to forces within us that are not under our voluntary control. You cannot will yourself to be happy. Happiness, perhaps, you can will yourself to be unhappy. You can cause yourself to be unhappy, but you can't do it for happiness. So when you experience it, you regard it as a miracle. It's something that seems to come from above. And now we're getting into the language question that we dealt with a lot when we talked about the university, the Liberty University conversation, that the historical Christians have, you know, begin with metaphysics, okay, the existence of God, and then you have epistemology, and then you have axiology, how we should act. And so, in a sense, in that structure, you can understand miracles of grace. But for Peterson and Žižek, well, they'll tend to be psychological categories because, again, they start with epistemology, and they're going to leave metaphysics completely out of it. And this is where Peterson lays down, and I just transcribed it as best I could, lays out his gospel again. And this was one of the best articulations for Jordan Peterson's gospel. And I should put that in quotes because this is his good news. Okay, that's what gospel means. And I'll just read it. The most effective means of pursuing the good life, which is not the same as pursuing happiness. I don't know why he didn't start with this, because I think that now I'm doing the nose thing. It's contagious. I don't know why I didn't start with this, because this seemed to be exactly what he should have said right out of the gate, and they could have had more of the evening to talk. The most effective means of pursuing the good life, which is not the same as pursuing happiness, is to adopt something like a stance of maximal responsibility towards the suffering and malevolence in the world. And I think that should be pursued as individual responsibility. It's not that I don't think that political and familial and larger organizations aren't necessary, but in the final analysis, we each suffer alone, and we have our own malevolence to contend with in some fundamental sense. The proper beginning of moral behavior, the right way to act in the world, is to take responsibility for that. This is Peterson's big deal right here. This is why he loves Solzhenitsyn. You do what you can to conceptualize the highest good you can. And if you're in the iron box of secularism, you can't see the stars. You just have to use a reasonable facsimile that's closest to you. A lot of that A-B testing that Sam Harris was talking about. It has to be personal. It has to be a personalized vision as well as a universalized vision. In other words, you have to have the Father and your Father. You have to be the Father in real life being the Father. You work diligently to ensure that your actions are in keeping with that, and you allow yourself to be informed by the knowledge of your ignorance and the necessity of acting and speaking in truth. That's derived from an underlying Judeo-Christian ethic. These stories metaphysically or philosophically or psychologically are as fundamental to the functioning of our society insofar as it functions properly. Metaphysically, we're going to have to talk about that. It's not happiness, it's meaning. You should have started with this. Meaning is to be found in the adoption of responsibility. You're acting in a manner with what you believe to be right, but in doing it, that simultaneously expands our ability to do it. It means you cannot stay safely within the confines of your current ethical beliefs. This is where we get into the order chaos thing. You have to stand on the edge of what you know and encounter continually the consequences of your own ignorance to expand your domain of knowledge and ability so that you're not only acting in an efficient manner, but you're increasing the efficiency and productivity and meaningfulness of what it is you're engaging in. I believe that even the neuropsychological evidence suggests that that's when true happiness descends. Notice the word, notice the directionality, it descends. We're deeply enmeshed in an axial age imaginatory with heaven above and earth below, where true happiness descends upon you because it's an indication from the deepest recesses of your psyche, biologically instantiated, that you're in the right place at the right time. This is the little internal gyroscope. You're doing what you should be doing and in a way that expands your capacity to do even better things in the future. Continuing the quotation, I think it's the deepest human instinct there is. It's not rational. It's far deeper than that. It's something genuine, and it exists within us. Plato and Aristotle at war here. Constitutes a proper guide if you don't pervert it with self-deception and deceit. So that's my perspective, says Jordan Peterson. That's his gospel right there. Those three slides of text, I think, are probably, well, it's from him, probably the best brief articulation of Jordan Peterson's gospel. It's right there. And you can go back and listen to me read it again. You can look at the bootleg version of this. It's right there. And again, I don't know why Peterson didn't just come out of the gate with that and say, Zizek, this is the world. This is our hope. This is our chance. It's right here. This is the best we can do within the iron box of secularism. This is the best I can substantiate with science. This is the best I can offer right here. And Zizek would say, I'm too pessimistic. I can't do his accent. And Zizek responds, I like this grace, or whatever we call it, this moment of happiness, because that's all you get with him. Would you agree that the same goes for love? You fall in love. You are surprised, shocked, even traumatic. You lead a stupidly happy life, and then you fall in love. And again, this is why I say, little lunch with Gary Habermas is not going to flip Jordan Peterson on the resurrection, because conversion is like falling in love. And actually, there's a Tim Keller clip I want to play one of these days that's going to deal with this, because this is a point Keller makes, and he makes it following on C.S. Lewis, that to be converted, to actually believe outside of the nihilism of Zizek, and even above and beyond that which can be scientifically justified by Jordan Peterson, requires, well, Kierkegaard called it a leap of faith. It requires falling in love. It means, well, does that mean you lose your rationality? No. It's you see through the light. You see because of the sun. C.S. Lewis. You fall in love. You are surprised, shocked, even traumatic. You lead a stupidly happy life, and then you fall in love, and it destroys what you thought was happiness. That's right. That's right. As Zizek goes on, I agree with the Judeo-Christian legacy for which I'm attacked. He says he gets attacked by this. I believe he's probably attacked by anyone who offers hope, even the Marxist and their utopianism. I, as an atheist, accept the spiritual value of it. It's like, ooh, I'd love to spend a few minutes with Zizek deconstructing that line. In other religions, we fall from God and we try to climb back. In Christianity, you don't climb to God. That's exactly right. You discover the distance from God is inscribed in God himself. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. That's God number two. The whole earth is full of his glory. That's God number one. That's why I agree with the intelligent theologists. These theologists he keeps talking about. I love it. Like his favorite G.K. Chesterton. My God, why have you abandoned me? Zizek even said, even gave it in Aramaic. God himself becomes an atheist. Boy, that's a clever line. It's a clever line. Some smart preachers are going to pick up on that sucker. Your separation from God is part of divinity itself. There's something to really think about. Zizek responds, that's why happiness is not some blissful unity with highest value. We have no hope for that. No Platonic hope. No hope even from Plotinus. It's the very struggle, the fall, and so on. That's why he's horrified by Ray Kurzweil's singularity. And here's what we get a sense of Zizek's joy. Zizek loves the struggle. He loves the darkness of it. He loves the darkness of it. That's what it is. And he enjoys it. And he's brilliant, and he's well-read, and he's clever, and he's creative. But He loves the tragedy of it. And so if, you know, the sun comes out, oh crap, why can't we have smog-filled skies? Well, don't worry, Zizek, that's your eschatology. And then another friendly attack. Again, Zizek, you got to watch this guy if you're going to talk to him because he's so friendly and he's so kind, but he sticks the knife in when he smiles. What if you discover that your house is in disorder because how society is messed up? And everyone cheers because, well, this is a point that's been made against Peterson. You, Jordan Peterson, are so socially active because of the society's house is in disorder. If you've really followed your own rules, then shouldn't you put your house in perfect order? And well, there you're dealing with a very interesting aspect to Jordan Peterson's rules, because in a sense, when he goes out and suggests how other people should live, he is pretty much saying, I've put my own house in order. And hey, I'm not gonna contest, I'm not gonna, you know, play the what has become the prophetic game in our society, which is pointing out the sin in everybody else's life. But implicit in the rule that Jordan lays out is a real vulnerability to hypocrisy. And a number of people have pointed this out to Peterson. And Zizek talks about recycling Coke cans can distract oneself with personal moralism rather than the big issue. A devastating point, and Peterson will pick it up a little bit later on. And then Peterson, quite cleverly, you know, Peterson, he's sharp. He listens well, and he takes notes. You know, even though he got off on the wrong foot, he was able to listen carefully. And Zizek isn't, with his flurry of nose wiping and accent and hand stuff, Peterson's focused. And he's listening carefully and he's taking notes. This guy didn't get to where he is by being a dummy. Peterson picks up on G.K. Chesterton at this point, and it's like, yeah, Jordan, you should read some G.K. Chesterton. Very smart dude. Jesus' crucifixion is an archetypal story. Even God himself might despair about the essential quality of being. Even God himself can fall prey to the temptation of doubt. Another thing that could take, I could launch hours of theology to ponder. Voluntary, now we get back to Jordan Peterson's gospel. Voluntary confrontation with what you're trying to avoid. Exposure therapy. We're called to face up to the unbearable reality. And here's his faith point. We don't know the upper limit. That is where Jordan Peterson, that is where, in a sense, where he imagines his science ends. And his faith begins. It's right there. Because you cannot demonstrate that truth claim, and that's exactly what Zizek is doubting. Now we get to his central psychological, Jordan Peterson's central psychological message of the biblical corpus. Boy, that perked up my ears. Life is fundamentally suffering and malevolence. We heard Verveke deal with that a little bit. And at some point, I think I want to take Peterson's first noble truth versus Verveke's first noble truth. And so, you know, if what I do on my channel sometimes is we take clips from one guy, take clips from another guy, put it together and say, ah, what about that? Is life suffering? Verveke deconstructs that fairly well, and I'd love to hear Peterson respond to that. Life is fundamentally suffering and malevolent, and on that, Zizek can agree, but the light that you discover is proportionate to the amount of darkness you're willing to forthrightly confront, and that there's no necessarily upper limit to that. And this is where we get a kind of stoicism. This is where we get a kind of gallows stoicism, where the, and I think Esther in her Quillette piece really nailed this. There's a chivalry in this where I am going to walk the green mile and I will not cry. I will rage into the darkness. But here's the question. We've had humans walking stoically to the gallows. Does that finally really address the hangman? Does that finally really address the injustice of it? Does that finally really fully address? And you might say, well, what about Christ? Well, what about Christ? Jesus isn't stoic in going to the cross, and this is actually one of the interesting issues between Matthew, Mark, and Luke, because they've got different audiences and there's different portrayals of Jesus in those audiences. And Luke has Jesus sometimes a little bit more stoic. And I know some people are going to react to that, but Jesus is the living word of the Old Testament, and he's expressive and passionate. And it's not enough for Jesus to just be stoic up until the end or to show himself as being in control. He's looking to take death down. This little Good Friday get together by these two, Easter Sunday comes along, and in the resurrection, Jesus says, I'm not happy to just be stoic. I'm going to do death in. That's the Christian message. Is the Bible really, as Jordan Peterson says? I think it's more. I don't think the Bible finally says it's up to you to save yourself. I think the Bible has a different message. Anyway, back to the quote. Good people are capable of is the good that people are capable is higher than the evil they are capable of. Now, again, this is a theological point, and is worthy of theological engagement. And right at that point where we left Peterson and Nasser, where Peterson is trying to figure out what is God acting and what is us acting. In a sense, it could point to the Heidelberg Catechism, because again, the God-man, this is how this gets resolved, because Jesus is fully man and fully God, so it's archetypal. But what does that say? I mean, I can agree with Peterson's statement if Jesus is the one conquering. And I can agree that as a Christian, if the Holy Spirit moves through us, we accomplish in many ways what Jesus accomplishes. But the Bible is clear, and the Apostle Paul is clear, that it is finally Christ and the principalities and powers. And this question of our work and Christ's work, and when is it Christ working through us and all of this? That's where you really have to work out this question theologically. And Peterson kind of puts it out there, but in this context, and given Jordan Peterson's shrinking back from other elements of the Christian faith, I think it's finally just humanism. And I think it's actually a misreading of the Bible. The central theological message of the Bible, of the corpus, is that humans are capable of defeating evil. Well, one human is, and his name is Jesus. That's, in a sense, what Christianity says. And Jesus does it because we're not able to. And it doesn't mean that we, and again, this is back to the confusion with a doctrine like total depravity, it doesn't mean that we're unable to defeat any evil. The question is, are we able to defeat all evil and every evil? Zizek obviously says no. Jordan Peterson's central biblical message of the biblical corpus. If you do that, you have the best chance, and for Jordan Peterson, it's a chance only, at setting your house in order and everyone else's house in order at the same time. And then he goes right back to his eschatology, which is Piaget's equilibrated state. Even in North Korea, and you know, I agree with, you know, there's plenty of nuance in here that I don't want to demolish, because my understanding of the Christian gospel says that even Haitians in dark Batays in the Dominican Republic or in difficult places of Haiti, even African slaves dragged over from Africa into slavery in the American South. Do we really seriously ponder the fact that what Africans did who were dragged over into slavery in the American South managed to do was not only take on the religion of their masters, but challenge their masters with their own religion? You should think about that. Think about that deeply. The best bet for most people, then here again, we're going to have to deal with time, do small problems and then be able to do larger problems. Good, true. This is wisdom. This is good advice. And then a quote by Jung, because no Jordan Peterson evening would be replete without a quote by Jung, complete without a quote by Jung. If you take a personal problem seriously, you may solve a social problem. And I think Jung is right. And I think this is a great point. And I think this is where Jung is helpful. You pay for your own mistakes by starting with yourself too. So there's justice in that. And I thought, again, these are points, these are points that I think Peterson makes very, very well. And I think real points scored that evening. And then Zizek goes on Hegel in the fall, which was very interesting. The fall is a felix culpa. Before the fall, we were simply animals. And there's a lot that Peterson can agree with in this, although they ran out of time. It is through the fall that you perceive goodness as what will drag you out of the fall. And boy, there's a long, long history of very deep debate between Christians about this. Look up the debate, infralapsarianism versus supralapsarianism. This was a debate within my subculture in the middle of the 20th century. The church fathers debated these points. Zizek and Peterson begin by talking about communism, happiness, and Marxism. And the best parts of the evening are all about Christian theology and not a theologian on the stage. You fall retroactively, your fall retroactively created what you fell from. That's a very interesting idea. That's tough for cheap moralists to accept. And Zizek is dead on right there. Again, the dude is brilliant, he's clever, he's fun to listen to, but does he really say there's any hope? Zizek then goes with his fascinations, what I call the fascinating by a liturgy of toilets. Gets into implicit beliefs. Oops, spelling error there. And a couple of videos again, I talked about James K. A. Smith and Desiring the Kingdom, because we're surrounded by liturgies all the time, so I'm not going to remake that point. The common things we do constitute liturgies of the deeper commitments we have. We are, in fact, always making metaphorical and metaphysical statements by the common ways we live our life, even toilets. And then Zizek says, I want to solicit a joke from you. I loved it. Again, this was such a good conversation. This was so much fun that in a sense, you can get distracted by the fun, like a lot of life, and not take some time to deeply listen for what's solid underneath. Because Peterson is finally a hopeful humanist, and Zizek is a merry pessimist or even nihilist. And then Peterson brings his gospel back in. People are possessed with ideas that aren't theirs. It's worse than ideas. It's personalities that aren't theirs, such as hedonism. And this is why Peterson, in my book, is the unauthorized exorcist. That's who he is. People should watch themselves and notice those times that they are possessed or doing the right things. So sit at the edge of your bed and pray that prayer. That's Jordan Peterson's prayer life, and he's talked about it multiple times recently. You have to figure out what constitutes you and what constitutes the lie, but ultimately here, you have to save yourself. There may be hope coming, but Jordan can't offer it securely. And he says this is more than Ayn Rand individualism, and then he's back to Piaget's equilibrated state. If you do that now and then, he can't offer security. You might be happy, and for that you should be profoundly grateful, because it's something like grace. So again, we're going to borrow the language from Christians while denying their metaphysic. And again, back to Zizek's pessimism. True greatness, and then this was a devastating point too. Really good stuff in here. The true greatness is what you, I almost wrote this wrong, in fact, because I thought Zizek misspoke, but on later thinking about it, I realized he didn't. Zizek says, true greatness is to do what you think is wrong for a higher cause. And his example of that was Himmler. Heinrich Himmler, the leader of the SS, who walked around with the Bhagavad Gita in his pocket. because he knew that these German officers, who more than likely were raised in the church, even a nominal Christianity, would have conscience problems doing these horrible things. So you had to give them an ideology. You had to give them a religion which would allow them to transcend even just the human impulses, even just the mirror neurons that would recoil us from doing the horrible things to these other persons, especially after almost 2,000 years of Christianity and the culture. And Žižek calls this false meaning. And this is, again, a pretty devastating attack on Peterson, because in a sense, Peterson keeps offering meaning, as in the gyroscope within the iron box of secularism, that this is enough. But Peterson keeps bringing in the Bible, and so in a sense, you got to take the top off your iron box to look up at the stars. Now what Peterson, in a sense, does is smuggle the Bible into the iron box via Jung, and so now we can have an evolutionary story that accounts for the wisdom of the Bible, but that then leaves you open to Brett Weinstein's points. So right here, it's all right there. And so you can have false meaning, this little internal gyroscope. And this is a point that I've made a lot, quite often with Peterson. You can feel meaning being a Nazi prison guard because you are exterminating the Jews for the higher cause of liberating humanity. You can be a Soviet prison guard. You are destroying the kulaks, and all of Ukraine is starved. But this is a necessary point for the higher evolution of class struggle. You can be mean to the white man and call him a racist, a racism that he can never get away with, for the greater cause of social liberation in critical theory. Once you have a great theory, you can do a lot of evil and justify it. This is a devastating point by Žižek, and it's one that Christianity has often been vulnerable to, because Christians have, in fact, done the same thing and used Christianity as a justification for horrible things. It's a devastating point. And he pushes it further. And he brings up Brian Victoria, who I'd never heard of, and Zen at War. And I've lately, because I've been watching a whole bunch of Korean pop dramas, I've been watching a lot of history, early 20th century, late 19th, early 20th century history of Japan. And that's been fascinating me. And it's interesting how the same dynamic happens with Zen Buddhism, which in America, you know, people on the street are like, oh, Christianity bad, Buddhism good. And so, well, guess what? Look at the history of Buddhism. You know, use Zen so that you can also, just like Himmler did, you can disavow Germans that had been raised with consciences and the Bible to do horrible things. Well, you can work Zen. You can work Zen the same way. Devastating. Zen Buddhist justification for Japanese imperial atrocities. Okay, I've got conversations in 20 minutes, so I got to wrap this baby up. What will you leave this then, the last question, from the studio audience or from the internet audience? What will you leave this debate with and why? Peterson, believe in the power of communication with people with different values. Good example of that. Wonderful conversation. I thought a lot of insight, you know, gave me a nice introduction to Žižek, some really good articulations, clear articulations of Peterson's gospel. And then he attacks critical theory. Žižek, again, I so enjoyed him. I so enjoyed him. I loved this conversation from start to finish. And Žižek's a nihilist and he's a pessimist, but he's a lot of fun to have at parties. So Žižek, if you're a leftist, don't feel obliged to be politically incorrect. And, you know, I thought Peterson was going to run across the street stage and give him a big wet kiss, because, you know, it was supposed to be a fight and it became a love fest. Don't be afraid to think. The laziness of labeling your adversary as commonly agreed upon bad thing, like a fascist. Beautiful point. And that's how the evening ended. So, Silent Explosion, that's who it was in the chat with Adam and Sitch. Silent Explosion. Žižek is a Marxist as Jordan Peterson is a Christian. I'm still rattling around in my head. Is Žižek really a Marxist? No, He's certainly not a progressivist. He's way too pessimistic. Is he just a plain nihilist who's having a good time on the way to destruction? Kind of seems like it to me. He claims to be a Hegelian, but he's way too pessimistic for a Hegelian. I don't want know what kind of Hegelian he really is. What kind of Christian is Jordan Peterson? Well, he says the psychological story of the Bible is that life is fundamentally suffering and malevolent, but the light that you discover is proportionate to the amount of darkness you're willing to forthrightly confront. He pretty much said this on stage at Liberty University. And that there's no necessarily upper limit to that. And that's a statement of faith. The good that people are capable of is higher than the evil they are capable of. That's a statement of faith. I've got issues with his description of the text, because I don't think you're really going to get... I understand the point. I understand how it's faith for you. But just on the basis of reading the text, and the reason being... you read Genesis. Who's the hero of Genesis? It's not Adam. Certainly not Cain. It's not Abraham. It's not Isaac. It's not Jacob. It's not even Joseph. It's God. God is the hero of Genesis. How about Exodus? We're going to be in Exodus. Who's the main actor in Exodus? God. They had forgotten his name. God swoops in. And he's been working behind the scenes with the midwives, and he calls Moses, and it's God who liberates. The story of the Bible is not about human capacity. When you look at human beings in the Bible, we're a mess from start to finish. There's one hero in the Bible. There's one perfect man in the Bible. It's Jesus, and we kill him. The Bible is not a story about human potential. You're just reading it wrong. It's his psychological take on it, and I think that's kind of leaves him a way out. Well, that's what people read when they read the Bible. Yeah, maybe Norman Vincent Peale, Donald Trump's old pastor. But I don't think that's what the Bible says, and I don't think you can really get there from the Bible. Maybe it's an unintended consequence of the text. Christianity has hardly been exorcised from our central cultural conversations. Look at this. They started a debate and a theological conversation broke out. Biblical apocalypticism is replaced by secular apocalypticism and pessimism. Humanity is on its own. There's no belief in a rescuing God. Zizek is pessimistic, but talking and thinking is fun, so let's enjoy the game while it lasts. Jordan Peterson believes in human potential, but is deeply conflicted as to how to think about metaphysics of the divine realm. And so that's why he remains an open agnostic. And then we're really back to Paul Maxwell's video about, well, the ancients started with metaphysics, and then they did epistemology, and then they did axiology. Peterson, as a modernist, starts with epistemology and says via Darwin, the best epistemology we can prove scientifically is that which promotes survival. That's his point. And that's how his epistemology works. And this is why he's got this faith. Well, maybe human beings can get over it. And if, in fact, Zizek is right and we don't and there is no God, Jordan was wrong. But Jordan would be like, we might as well try. Zizek is hosting an entertaining intellectual buffet of insights as we travel towards our self-inflicted doom. That's him. Nature would kill us eventually, but we'll beat her to the punch. So on the way, we'll see if we can do some good and have a good time. Slow down our self-destruction if we can and enjoy the ride. And Peterson, meaning is fully engaged. Don't forget Zizek's mentioning Himmler and Zen Buddhist atrocity development. That's the thing about meaning. Peterson likes to make the point about following meaning, but then he makes the point about the Judeo-Christian tradition. And the thing is, the Judeo-Christian tradition acts like guiding stars. In other words, you can't just have meaning without the morality of what's being pointed at from the Bible. Because you can find meaning in Zen Buddhism. You can find meaning in being a Nazi prison guard. You can find meaning in being a Japanese prison guard that tortures Louis Zamperini. Read Unbroken. He probably felt very meaningful. You know, the universe was being rebalanced because of, you know, Japan's destiny to rule the world. Once the U.S. kind of broke the isolation of Japan by Commander Perry, well, Japan set on a course to rule the world. Asia first. I mean, it's a giant game of Risk. They just got started late. Napoleon got there long before they did. If we as individuals confront the darkness, we may summon up enough goodness to dispel it. That's Jordan's message. But then you've got a time frame question with Jordan and it's really interesting because when he talks to Nasser, he gets into the question of time frame with respect to eschatology. And that's exactly right. And so if I'm feeling meaning now, does that mean I'm saved? Well, the problem with moments is that one moment leads to a next. Well, what is then salvation? What constitutes, well, how in can the equilibrated state and time exist simultaneously? Hope for the conscious now, but is the metaphysical substrate upon which we depend ultimately either doomed? See, that's the problem. I didn't finish my thought. Is it doomed either by individual death, universal end of life, what I call the age of decay? Peterson is a modernist. I may need more time to think about the metaphysical question, which is the question of the resurrection. And I think that's why he keeps getting to that point and stumbling, because you're not going to deal with the physical resurrection of Jesus and not deal with metaphysics, because it fundamentally alters the kind of story that we're living in, and it destroys materialism. And it asks fundamental questions about what exactly is the underlying nature of reality? Are we, in fact, an ongoing story? And I want to use simulation here, but see, I think simulation is the wrong word. I'm going to have to do a video entirely on that, because simulation, the simulation argument, I find points people today in the right direction in terms of thinking about what they should be thinking about in terms of maybe there's an author. And maybe, as Shakespeare said, all the world is a stage. But then what does that do to, it doesn't afford Zizek's pessimism. And Peterson's going to have to go a ways before he really begins to deal with metaphysics. Because that Judeo-Christian corpus, that metaphysical question is answered by the claims of that event, which is the resurrection, which made this a very poignant conversation for Good Friday 2019. So, there's my take. Let me know what you think in the comment section.